Jim Packardin for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us today as we talk about our climate and weather. Here in studio, Professor Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Steve, it's a pleasure to see you.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
And Professor John Martin is chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at the UW-Madison. John, always a pleasure to see you, too.
Same here, Jim.
Tornadoes swarmed in the southern plains recently, with as many as 20 tornadoes reported in Oklahoma. One of those caught on tape was a multi-vortex tornado, and we need a definition of multi-vortex tornado.
It's one with multiple tornadoes in it.
Yeah. No. That's true.
That's true, though, right?
Yeah. That's the basic.
And by that it means there's a difference, I guess we should clarify, is that, you know, you can have a family of tornadoes, which are individual tornadoes separately rotating to get individually, or in this multiple vortex, it actually is one tornado with inside there you've got other vortices that are spinning around inside this envelope of the bigger, larger one.
Yeah, and that's actually a theory that's out there now about tornadoes and tornado genesis, is that that's how they all have that characteristic, is that they're braided connections between several vortices that come down as the one big funnel. Yeah. That's not well known, yeah, whether that's true or not.
And I think because in the past we didn't penetrate them, so we didn't really know. So if the tornado gets really big and gets a lot of debris, mm-hmm, you could have multiple vortexes inside and you just can't see them visually.
Yeah, because you wipe everything away.
Right.
So if there are more tornado chasers, then is the chances of seeing this greater than it would be, you know, if you're just huddled?
I think there would be, because you'd have more of a chance before you get a lot of that debris to cover them. But I think also, you know, more equipment and better equipment to actually penetrate beyond the debris, which hides things visually.
I agree.
You can see them.
Yeah, and these are usually fairly sharp people going out there looking for them. They know what they're doing, yeah, to some degree, and so that they end up with good observations.
Well, I'll tell you, though, some of the footage that you see on the Weather Channel, or for instance, it's just scary.
I
mean, just to see it on film or on video is scary.
I have never seen a tornado, and to be honest, I never really want to see a tornado.
Yeah, no, I kind of want to see it the same way I see something like a ball game from a comfortable seat, you know, no chance of injury.
On YouTube.
Yeah, right. Something like that.
Yeah, there was a big one in South Dakota that somebody was passing around photos of, that one. That was a monster.
Oh, yeah.
A monster size. Yeah, it's just crazy.
All right. The number for you to call is 1-800-642-1234 if you have questions or comments about our weather and climate. We had an email from Mark, and he wonders, we occasionally hear forecasters say Gulf moisture funneling north will fuel local thunderstorms, and he's wondering if oil from the spill in the Gulf of Mexico can be carried up here from the Gulf and then rain down upon us.
Hmm. I don't know if the hydrocarbons evaporate so well. I mean, if that would be a threat, if they, to the extent that they evaporate along with liquid water and there's a vapor of a mixture of a hydrocarbon particulate maybe that comes from that spill and water vapor that comes north in those air masses. But I don't think that stuff evaporates at these temperatures.
Yeah, I think it'd be pretty hard.
In the troposphere.
I know we have gotten smoke from, like, the Yucatan, big fires in there, and then the right flow southerly up has brought a smoke all the way up into Wisconsin. That's come from fires in Mexico. But that's so, I mean, theoretically, yeah, we can transport all that up here. Mm-hmm. The question is, yeah, how much is getting into the air versus how much is really still bonded?
Yeah, and that is the key question. Yeah.
Now, both of you addressed very casually today, because today is another one of those hot days where summer has arrived early in the state of Wisconsin.
I am not ready for 90-degree weather in May. Well, I'm just not ready.
Neither is the Beltline, apparently.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah,
and other roads.
Highways buckling, yeah. I-39, I noticed.
I-39 buckle too?
Yeah. Oh, down near Janesville.
Yeah.
Holy mackerel.
Yeah, it's quite amazing. It's certainly not without precedent, but it doesn't happen that often that we get above 90 degrees in May. I honestly should have looked this up, but I think that anecdotally from my own experience, I don't think it's happened in the last 10 years.
Yeah. I mean, we didn't have any 90-degree weather last summer.
Summer at all. I think that's correct. So the number of 90-degree days is down to a handful now.
So what is setting up in the atmosphere that enables us to have this kind of weather, and then you look to the west and things are much, much cooler?
Yeah, it's consistent, actually. There's a big upper-level trough to the west of us, and the troughiness in the middle troposphere usually leads to cloudiness and precipitation. And so places to our immediate west have not had this heat wave. But then the other consequence of having a trough axis to your west in the troposphere is that you have southwesterly flow over us, and it comes right off the Mexican Plateau, the western Gulf of Mexico, and so you get the combination of really warm temperatures and high humidity. So this is the way we get our extreme heat, and it happens a few times every summer.
All right, let's go to Bill in La Crosse next. And Bill, what can we do for you? Bill, what can we do for you? Apparently, no. Bill, there? All right. We'll just have to forget about him at the moment. What are some other things going on as far as Wisconsin's weather that seem unusual?
I think what seems unusual to me is actually something that's kind of usual, and that is that throughout most of the state of Wisconsin for the month of May, the temperature was on average what a 30-year mean is. So it wasn't an abnormal month with regard to temperature, averaged over the whole. But, you know, in the end, we're getting really hot, sticky days at the end of the month and kind of cool days, weather in the beginning of the month,
yeah.
If I remember right.
It's a good point. The average can be delivered in a number of ways.
Right. Yeah.
The average in April, I forget if it was warmer or not.
It was warmer by a lot.
It was a very warm April. And then March was, I think, warmer than normal. But we had several months in the fall that were about average. And yet, no one has a memory of what happened in those months because it wasn't an average delivered to you by the first half of the month being much cooler than normal and the second half being much warmer or some combination like we've had this month of May. So that's somewhat unusual. But as you point out, it gets us exactly to normal at the finish line of the month.
I think we're ready for Bill's call from La Crosse. Hi, Bill. No? Bill? Huh. All right. Well, let's wait, and we'll try something else.
Didn't La Crosse hit 90 degrees, too?
Call-in number.
They must have.
I think they hit 90 degrees, too, in Eau Claire and that whole area. Yep. Yeah.
1-800-642-1234 is our telephone number, and our email address is talk@wpr.org as we talk today about Wisconsin's climate and weather. Let's talk about the Gulf and the problems down there. I noticed that the currents are expected to drive this oil up the East Coast. At any point, is this a problem for us inland?
Oh boy! Assuming that we're not getting what we were just talking about with regard to the molecules being evaporated into the air and being transported up. I would say impact directly, probably not. I mean, certainly there's a lot of indirect effects in terms of, the type of food supplies we'll be getting and the economic impact that'll happen down there.
Yeah,
as
that's
well.
For sure. We're all in the same economic boat when it comes to how bad this thing's going to be for the country.
Yeah.
We're all going to feel it. But I think direct effects of actually seeing things like the people down in the marshes in Louisiana or on the beaches in Alabama, Mississippi, and in Louisiana are seeing oil and various other right-in-your-face pollutants, we may not see any of that.
Mm-hmm. It is interfering with... I mean, you could see these things in satellites really nicely. It's really some amazing photo imagery. But it's also screwing up our observations of the sea surface temperatures down there, which are, of course, important for hurricane forecasts.
Right.
So we don't really know now what the temperature is and what the temperature is below the surface of that oil either. So is hurricanes, if they move into that area this year, is that energy supply going to be available or not? It's kind of an interesting question that's coming
up. Yeah, and I don't know myself if hurricanes are actually something that a person who has spilled billions of gallons of oil would be hoping for at this point. Maybe they are because that's a good way to mix the pollutant and decrease its effect over a wider area, but you'd affect a wider area, but it would be less lethal in those small pockets.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that's actually the way it works.
Right.
They say the third time is charm, so let's give Bill another chance. Bill, are you there? Yeah. Bill, go ahead.
Yes, okay. Well, basically a follow-up to what you're talking about. I understand that the oil slick covering thousands of square miles of Gulf water will have two very dramatic effects. Number one is that the temperature underneath that oil slick could warm up possibly 10 degrees greater than normal temperatures in the Gulf in the hot months coming upon us. And the second effect might be the dramatic decrease of evaporation of surface waters. And so these two effects might dramatically affect the hurricanes or the tornadoes that are going to be resulting, and possibly we might see even a severe tornado lifting up surface oil and carrying it up to maybe 10 miles inward and dramatically increasing the environmental catastrophe that we're already witnessing. I just wondered what your reactions to these ideas.
Yeah, no, that's certainly right with regard to what you're talking about, the impact on the surface temperatures. What will happen if a hurricane moves into that area is going to be really interesting, in the sense that once you begin to mix that oil up with the water that's down below, you could be bringing up really warm sea surface temperatures again, which, again, fuel the storms.
But only if the water evaporates. So they do tend to work against each other. The slick will reduce evaporation. So.
But that'll keep it. But evaporation causes a cooling process. So that'll keep the Gulf even warmer.
But you do have to ingest water vapor into that storm. You're right.
Tend to. You got to mix it. You got to bring in a storm. You're probably not going to generate a storm.
Yeah. But you're right. I think when you start to mix up the water, you're going to expose warmer water, which is readily available for evaporation. So it could be really wild. And then tornadoes that come with hurricanes at landfall, this is a big research question, is about how they actually get generated and why they're so numerous. But tornadoes at landfalling hurricanes would certainly have the ability to eject some of that stuff that's on the surface of the water into places that you wouldn't expect it to get otherwise. How big those implications would be for the catastrophe is another question.
Bill, thank you very much for the call. Glad to get an answer for you. As we talk about climate and weather with Steve Ackerman and John Martin here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Jim Packard on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we talk today about our climate and weather with Professor Steve Ackerman and Professor John Martin. Good to see both of you here in studio again today.
It's great to be here.
Always the first Monday of the month, but in this case, it's the first Tuesday.
Last Monday.
Monday of the month. And today, because you've got a holiday coming up on Monday, you are here today, but we'll be back on your regular schedule next month.
Yeah. We hope so. Yeah.
Yes, indeed. Let's take some phone calls with Bill in Oregon next. Hi, Bill.
Hi, how you doing? I see the northern ice sheet looks like it's headed for a new record low, and I was wondering if that volcano in Iceland would be dusting the top of it with ash that would attract more heat and therefore melt more, and just sort of like what the wind currents look like up around that region and where that ash does go.
Yeah, actually, that's a good question, because, yeah, that's how it can contribute to the melting of ice, is by the deposition of the ash, which, again, leads to more solar energy absorption. But most of the images that I have looked at, unfortunately, they tend to head to the south and southeast of there, and not up towards the polar cap. Mm-hmm. And that's why there's been so much problems with airlines. Because if it was up high, people can fly around it, but it's going over the land where the airports are, and that's where the landings and the takeoff occur. So.
Yeah, and I think even if it were to hit some ice, it's probably going to only have a regional effect. That's not a gigantic volcano. And the amount of ash that actually gets on the ground and increases or decreases the albedo probably won't be so big.
It's very plume and rope structure.
Right, that's right.
In terms of the winds in the region there, what can you say about that?
Yeah, most of them are, because it's not a real explosive one in the sense that it's getting really high, the ash is. And so it's really being driven by low-level winds and mid-level winds. And most of those are going to heading towards the east or down towards the southeast. They're not pushing it up north.
That's right.
Yeah.
Bill, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate hearing from you. Let's go next to Al in Suring. Hi, Al.
Hi, Jim. How you doing?
Very good today.
Good. Excellent program. I have a question for the professors. I'm in production agriculture in northeast Wisconsin, and particularly Oconee County, and we've been into a kind of a drought situation over the last 2 or 3 years, and I don't know what global warming has effect on this or not. I know that in the last 30 years that I've been farming, it seems that we're getting in the fields earlier every year. So, you know, I don't know if we can get an answer to this or not. Being in production agriculture, it has a direct effect on my livelihood.
No. Yeah, the certainly the growing season in terms of temperature has increased by as much as 10 days to 2 weeks, depending on where you're looking at. But the drought that's been occurring up in the north parts of Wisconsin and north parts of Minnesota, I don't think we really yet understand why it isn't raining, why the storms aren't hitting
it
up
there. It just seems hard to explain. I mean, I know a couple of weekends ago, the northwestern part of the state got a little bit of relief.
Yeah,
for the first time in a while, a storm finally came by that seemed to have, you know, that target on its back and dropped a little bit of rain there. But the accumulated effect of the storm track being just a little bit off or not varied enough when it comes up in our region is enough to put one spot in a drought.
Yeah.
Over a period of a number of years. And I guess that getting in the fields a little early is not only, as you point out, Steve, the longer growing season, but also given the fact that it's been a drought up there, not so much snow. So it just makes it easier to get out. You don't have to wait for all the melt to sort of dry away before you can get to work. And that's bad because the ground loses water throughout the whole winter if you don't have too much snow cover. So all of these things contribute to
They are. Lake levels are down on everything around here, and we've been getting in the field earlier in the spring. And planting later in the fall, it's just the weather conditions have been that warm. But my biggest concern is no water.
Yeah, the water, the lack of water has been just chronic up there. And we don't really have, as Steve says, we don't really have a good understanding of that right now.
And the funny thing is that it was northwestern part of the state where you noticed it first, and it's been most persistent. But now going all the way across the state into Oconda County, it shows you how big this area is.
Yeah, right. That's right.
Very good program.
Thanks. All right, Al. Thanks very much. Good luck to you, and we hope that get some moisture.
Yeah,
yeah.
I hope it rains.
Yeah. Matt in Madison is next. Hi, Matt.
Hey, how are you guys?
Good.
Okay. A couple of weeks ago, or maybe 2 weeks ago, there was a super outbreak of tornadoes out in the Oklahoma area. But what was rare about that was they had plenty of warning. I think they had 4 or 5 days. Well, that brought in a bunch of storm chasers, and I've been just following the storm chasing community, and it just seems like there's a lot of problems with storm chasers. There's too many of them, or they're just being inappropriate while out on the road. I was just wondering if I could get an opinion of your guests of storm chasers and if they have any value here in the Wisconsin area.
One of my colleagues, Professor Charles Doswell from the University of Oklahoma, some years ago wrote an article in the Bulletin of the American Meteorological Society, actually suggesting a list of ways to behave for storm chases. And some of the things just seemed so obvious to me. I've not been on a chase, but things like you don't drive across somebody's property, plowed fields and so on. But apparently this is what some people do when they're out there. There's going to be a mixture of people who are out there for really solid scientific/hobby reasons. They know what they're doing. They make sure that they have a command center somewhere that's telling them where to go. But then there's also going to be a few yahoos out there. And I think that probably some of the bad behavior is very high profile from that crowd. And that I guess that a larger percentage of people do behave themselves in a reasonable way and have a really good time, you know, searching for these storms. I'm not sure what benefit they serve across our own state. I think it does, as we mentioned earlier in the show, it does help to increase the number of reports of storms, and therefore the statistics about what actually happens are enhanced. Aside from that, I can't really think of another thing that's particularly positive about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are two aspects. One is research, and those are really people who do this for a living, and they go out with good equipment. Although, anytime you go chasing, you're putting yourself at risk.
That's true.
Because they're unpredictable, so you don't know where they're really going to end up. And then there's an education value. So we do have a professor here who every other summer, I think, has a severe weather class, and if the conditions are right, they'll go out and chase and go look for one. But again, they have a lot of connections back to the UW, back here to our department, and routinely monitoring data. And
that's right.
Like that.
They really model the correct behavior for chasing. Exactly right.
Yeah, I haven't chased and I have no interest, which means that at some point I will see one. I'm convinced.
Yeah, right.
If you don't go looking, you'll find one.
They tend to find you.
Right.
Matt, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
You bet. Thanks very much. And let's go to Dennis in Madison. Hi, Dennis.
Hey, good afternoon. And this is following up on the two calls ago, the farmer from up north with no water.
Okay.
Would you explain to me why it is that the TV weather forecasters and radio weather forecasters dislike moisture so intently. It's always, thank goodness that storm stayed to the south of it. Everyone's going to be able to go to their festival this weekend. Or the 6-inch snowstorm stayed to the north. Thank God we missed that. I mean, it is very, very, very anti having any moisture on the ground. And I just can't understand why the reports year after year after year are so negative on their part whenever there's moisture in the forecast.
I don't know. I mean, it's an interesting observation in the sense, in two aspects. As you're talking, I'm thinking one of the importance of moisture for an area and the rain and the vegetation. And if we don't have enough of it and our lawns turn brown, we all get really upset. But on the other hand, you know, a rain event can really wreck an outing. And I'm wondering if that wouldn't be part of the contribution of it.
Yeah. Maybe.
You know, and again, that short-term thinking of weather versus climate in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
You know, climate-wise, we want a lot of precipitation in order to have vegetation and food. But short-term, weather-wise, we may be thinking, what am I going to do this weekend? I don't want it to rain.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's true. And it may be a corporate slant to this, too. Maybe in some of these larger media markets, they're sort of told, you know, let's create an atmosphere in which we don't want to talk about precipitation because it tends to ruin people's plans, but they forget, like Steve said, that it's of great economic value to our state and to the nation.
But it'd be interesting just to listen to shows for like the summertime and just, you know, keep track of when do they say something negative about precipitation, you know, in a value judgment, not in a scientific judgment.
Yeah,
and when do they say something positive about it raining?
Interesting.
Yeah.
Dennis, thanks for the call.
Thanks,
you bet. Thank you very much. I think it's because they just don't want to deliver bad news.
They don't want to.
They've got this happy sort of feeling that the audience has for them, and if they give them bad news like rain, suddenly they're going to suffer or low self-esteem.
And I'm thinking personally, too, that, you know, when we get a lousy weekend, I think to myself, darn, why does this have to happen on the weekend? Because they want to go out and do something. But,
true, but
you know, I want the rain.
So Dennis's point and the caller before suggests that it's not bad news to everybody.
Right. Thanks very much, Dennis. We appreciate hearing from you. Robert is next in Dunbar. Hi, Robert.
Hi. My question is how has the recent 3-degree pole shift affected our recent weather patterns, referring to the 8.5 in Chile? I was wondering if you guys had any answers to that.
The 8.5?
8.5 earthquake that was
in
Chile
months
ago.
Yeah.
That caused a 3-degree pole shift. If that's causing the difference in weather patterns that we're experiencing.
No, I'd be really surprised. I mean, I know that a big earthquake like that can change the rotation rate of the Earth, the length of the day, a few things like that, but only very fractionally. And so I'd be surprised if there's any connection at all between that particularly strong event and the way the atmosphere around the globe reacts to that. I'd be surprised if there's any connection at all.
All right. I was just curious.
Okay. Robert, thanks very much. Telephone number for you is 1-800-642-1234. As we talk with Steve Ackerman and John Martin about our climate and weather, we have a couple lines open if you'd like to get in. And, of course, the email address is talk@wpr.org. Let's go to Richard in Sheboygan next. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Jim. I've been reading, actually quite a long time ago now, that part of the concern we have about the water levels in the lake, actually Lake Michigan, was affected by what the Army Corps of Engineers were doing in the St. Clair River near Detroit. I understood that they were dredging that and in order to allow larger ships to flow through that area. But in so doing, it was like pulling a plug on a bathtub. And the result was the water was receding. Now, I don't know if that's accurate or not, but I wanted to get the guy's reaction to that because I know as a summertime resident of Washington Island, we're very concerned about water levels up there. And it had been down as much as 4 feet. Guys have an idea about that?
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure, but here's what runs through my mind. Or I'm not sure, I don't know. I confess. But here's what runs through my mind. I mean, I think you guys are still like a foot and a half to 2 feet below the what's called the normal height, right, of the water level?
Right, yeah.
Yeah. So that, I mean, and that's not, that goes for Lake Michigan, Lake Huron, and Lake Superior as well. That's a huge amount of water.
It sure is.
So I can't imagine that dredging or deepening the canal it would cause that much. I mean, it must be part of the evaporation precipitation cycle.
Yeah.
That must be contributing to this real low low levels, which have been that way for a couple of years now.
Yeah, that's my instinct too, is that, you know, it certainly contributes to a draining of the lakes, but not in the sort of scale that you actually see on the shoreline. It just, that's too big a drain.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it can't be the primary factor.
So with what we are left, would you suggest that this is climate change, or would you think this is a normal cyclical circle?
You know, it could be a combination of both, in the sense that even though we're below normal, it's not at its lowest levels that it has been in the past. And so it could be part of a cycle that we just haven't been able to figure out yet. I mean, how little we know about the Great Lakes, to me, is shocking.
Stunning.
It's just shocking how much we don't
stunning.
Know.
It is absolutely stunning.
You know, and you know, so we're both East Coasters, so we can say this, I think, is that I think there's a bias to studying the coasts that are on the oceans and not the interior coasts. Because we should know the cyclic structure of the Great Lakes. We should know this stuff in a lot of detail. It seems like we're missing a lot of big pieces.
Yeah, and I'll bet some people in limnology here at our institution know about as much as anybody in the world about it, but I think they might even agree that it's not as much as we probably should know.
It's a very understudied watershed, I think.
I'm surprised about that being the large quantity of fresh water in the country. Or
in the world.
In the world, yeah.
Yeah, Lake Superior has 20% of the world's fresh water in it.
Yeah.
So the whole lake system.
We need to know
system,
more about it, don't we?
We do.
We sure do.
Richard, thanks for bringing up that point, and I suspect that these gentlemen will try to get an answer for you, or at least get some more studies on it.
Yeah.
Sue in Lake Geneva, let's give you a chance. Hi, go ahead.
Well, good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
On my way driving home last Sunday afternoon, in the sky, about a quarter to seven at night, I was a passenger, and I saw what looked like to me a wider diameter of a sun dog. It took a good portion of the sky, and we saw all the rainbow and all that, but it wasn't a sun dog. A sun dog is rather close to the sun, whereas this one was a whole lot wider in diameter.
Hmm.
Huh. You guys know what that would be?
Wait, so was it still arc structured?
Yes.
In it? Okay.
Yeah.
And
three-quarters of a circle.
Three-quarters of a circle. Wow. And where was it in relation to the sun? You know, to the right, the top, the bottom?
It was to the right of the sun.
It was to the right.
And we were driving west.
Huh. And was it cloudy out or clear?
Partly cloudy skies.
Partly cloudy, yeah. It still may have been a sun dog that just got really big.
The aura was just bigger.
Yeah, and it has to do with the ice crystal sizes and the concentrations. And if you get just the right mixture of concentrations and size, you can generate a really big sun dog. And I'm thinking, what's making me think of this is a colleague of ours, Grant Petty. He saw a huge sun dog, and he took a photo and he sent it around saying that this is the biggest sun dog that he had ever seen. And that occurred about a month ago, so it's probably not the same one as you saw. But
very interesting.
Yeah.
But something about springtime clouds, maybe.
It was awesome because you could see it filtered through the sky.
And could you see all the colors, red and yellows? And
yes.
Yeah, wow.
Wow.
Yeah.
They were very faint.
You're lucky.
Did you get a picture? Too bad, because we're redoing our intro book to weather and climate, and we could use a really good photo of a sun dog.
So if you see one, why, take a shot.
Okay.
Sue, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate hearing from you. Some emails coming in. Dave from Madison wanted to know Fahrenheit versus Celsius, what are their origin, and why do we have these two systems?
Actually, we have three systems. We also have the Kelvin, which is
the
Kelvin, which is the absolute scale.
Yeah,
Celsius scale was developed by some guy named Celsius.
Right? Yeah, right.
And it's based on the boiling point and freezing points of water,
fresh water,
fresh
and
water.
And that's where the Fahrenheit story comes in. And I didn't learn this till I was in graduate school, because I always wanted kind of the same thing. I thought, I want to be able to defend the temperature scale that we always use when we talk to each other about how warm or cold it is outside. Right. And that's Fahrenheit scale. Well, it turns out it's not like I was taught in high school physics. It's an arbitrary goofball scale. It's not arbitrary at all. 32 degrees Fahrenheit is the freezing point of fresh water. 0 degrees Fahrenheit is the freezing point of seawater. And that's a pretty relevant characteristic if you live in a maritime community. You want to know if you're going to have ice accumulating on the sides and decks of your ship and the rigging. So 0 degrees Fahrenheit is not some goofball number. It really means it's the freezing point of seawater. So that's pretty neat.
I did not know that.
I didn't know it either until just several years ago.
What I find really confusing is that when we talk about surface temperatures in the United States, we talk about Fahrenheit.
Yeah.
And then as soon as you go to upper air temperatures, we switch.
Celsius.
And go to Celsius.
Well, because nobody lives in the upper air.
Well, see,
and it's more accurate in Fahrenheit. There are simply more gradations on your scale. You know, there's a difference between 85 and 86. It's covered by the same thing on the Celsius scale.
We had Jane in New London ask, are there tornadoes in Europe?
Yes, there are.
Yeah.
They don't have nearly as many as we have in the United States, and that has to do a lot with the geography of the United States, of how it allows the instability conditions to occur. But I know France has had some.
Southeastern Spain gets them fairly frequently. And it's funny you say about the geography. That's the only part of Southwest Europe that really has some of the same ingredients. They don't have them quite as well as we do. They have the Atlas Mountains to their south in Morocco, and then the Mediterranean, the western and southern Mediterranean, which provides warm, moist air at the low levels, and then the Atlas Mountains allows dry, poorly stratified air to invade at upper levels. And that produces conditions that are an echo of the kind that we get over the central plains of the United States, where we have the Gulf of Mexico and the Mexican Plateau in near proximity.
In fact, every continent has had one except for Antarctica.
Antarctica.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's right.
Naomi in Hayward says, we had 95 degrees yesterday in Hayward, and 80 miles away it was 52 with fog and drizzle in Duluth.
God bless that lake. Right? That's where it's
what
coming
a huge
from.
Effect that has.
Wow.
Don't worry.
That's got to be some kind of record.
I mean,
that's bigger than for a non-frontal passage.
Yeah, that's gigantic.
To have a 40-degree temperature change over that distance.
Don't worry, Duluth. Summer's coming. You'll enjoy that weekend.
That's right.
Jen in Milwaukee has a question. Go ahead.
Thank you. I always get an education listening to the NPR. My daughter lives in Hawaii, and for almost 2 years, Haleakala has been spewing sulfur dioxide and shutting out the sun for weeks on end sometimes. And I'm wondering if that has any effect on any of the weather coming east. We never hear about it over here in the 48. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a good question. And you used the word spewing, so I would imagine it's not an eruption. So my guess would be that sulfur actually can turn into little particles and be very good, what we call cloud condensation nuclei. Mm-hmm. They can generate cloud droplets really quickly. And so I would think we might be seeing, with regard to weather, maybe changes in cloud amounts in that immediate area.
Yeah.
But I think it would probably get precipitated out before it actually gets up here and impacts up here.
I think that's right. And also, if you look at the whole map of the Pacific even, it's only a fraction of the globe, the Hawaiian Islands are a pinprick. And if one little volcano, it's not little if you live near it, but of course it's little on the global scale, probably doesn't have a global effect on the weather. Because it simply isn't explosive enough, as Steve points out.
Yeah. Jen, thanks for the call. Michael in Ferryville, let's see if we can get your question answered. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. There's just some people that like to bungee jump. Some people like to hang glide. Some people like to, there's all kinds of adrenaline things. And I really, really like to run in thunderstorms. And I actually went out this morning. And, lightning striking all around, like, the crazier it is, the better. And I'm just wondering, and I went with my dogs, too, which they're getting used to it. But anyways, what are my chances, really, of getting struck? I mean, because
I've got
really
about 30 seconds to answer this.
The probability of getting struck by lightning is like winning the major lottery. So it doesn't occur a lot. But of course,
but I think those probabilities are based on everybody, not those who play. And if you go out in the lightning, you have a sizably higher risk of getting struck by lightning because you may be one of the only things that's out.
Yeah. So, I'm surprised the dogs will handle it.
Yeah.
Our dog hated it.
Yeah, I would not advocate that.
Michael, thanks very much. Good luck to you. And next month, the weather guys will be back on Monday, June 28th. Thanks to Steve Ackerman, John Martin. Appreciate your being here today.
Thank you.
And if you'd like a CD of the program, it's available through the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. I'm Jim Packard. Thanks to Rachel Owens for on-air production today. Tomorrow, Mark Moffat, author of Adventures Among Ants, a global safari with a cast of trillions here on the Ideas Network.